Now, I want to read, please, if you have a Bible with you, in the book of Numbers tonight, the book of Numbers. And to a certain extent, we're following on from what Kevin brought before us and coming out of the land of Egypt and through the Red Sea. And we're just encamped at the outset and the beginning of the book of Numbers at Mount Sinai. So the book of Numbers. And we're going to read some verses together in chapter 6. Now, just before we get there, and I hope this doesn't upset too many of you, I need to give you just a little précis, really, a little summary of the first 10 chapters of the book of Numbers. Oh dear, I hope too many of you aren't groaning and moaning as I announce that we were turning to the book of Numbers, but the ministry tonight will be particularly, I trust, practical and challenging to us, as it has to me. I want to speak to you tonight about the route to blessing. That's what I'm going to call it, the route to blessing. And essentially, we're going to be thinking about preparations for the wilderness journey. Because you understand, though the book of Numbers is the book of the wilderness, well, in the first 10 chapters, the children of Israel aren't moving anywhere at all. It's not until you get right to the end of chapter 10 that they actually seek to move out according to the commandment of God. So you might say that for these first 10 chapters, they are stuck at the foot, or at least in the environment of Mount Sinai. And they've been there for 11 months. And of course, all of that has, that time has included the giving of the law and so on. But these first 10 chapters are incredibly important, because what God is doing is he is preparing his people for the wilderness, and he is preparing them for the journey that they are about to undertake. Of course, it took a lot longer than it should have, but there was much necessary preparation. And I think it will help us, it should help us, in terms of the application of our walk through the wilderness. So you'll just notice this with me. Look at Numbers chapter 1. I'm not particularly going to read any of these verses, but I just want you to see what is here. So in Numbers chapter 1, if we try and alliterate it, then there is a responsibility, or a requirement, if you like, to count. And what we are counting in Numbers chapter 1 is those who were of fit age to be engaged in combat. So Numbers chapter 1, there is a requirement to count, and there is a requirement for combat, and they would need that as they were going through the wilderness. When it is that you come to chapter 2, chapter 2 presents a requirement in relation to the camp. And the fact that this camp wasn't at all to be haphazard, but as you well know, and we'll think about this later, it was very well ordered around the sanctuary and around the tabernacle. So a requirement for counting and for combat, chapter 1, and for camping in chapter 2. And then when you come to chapters 3 and 4, the requirement is in relation to carrying. And of course, we have the sons of Levi, the Kohathites, the Merarites, the Gershonites. And in chapters 3 and 4, they are given various different responsibilities to carry the items that belonged to the tabernacle. And they would need to be carried through the wilderness. Chapter 5, well, that's all about cleansing. There's really just a change in emphasis. If chapters 1 to 4 has been about the order and the organization of the camp, well, when you come to some of these chapters now, it's about purity. It's about cleansing. It's about cleanliness. And you'll notice just at the outset of chapter 5, verse 2, command the children of Israel that they put out of the camp every leper and every one that hath an issue, and whosoever is defiled by the dead, and so on, because, verse 3, in the midst whereof I dwell. So chapter 5 is all about cleansing. And we are going to notice later on tonight that there are some very strange verses. that we sometimes call the jealousy offering, that you find in the middle and towards the end of Numbers chapter 5, but it's cleansing. And from chapter 5, there then is the thought of consecration. Numbers chapter 6 is very well known, isn't it, for the vow of the Nazarite. So in Numbers chapter 6, you have the consecration. It was a temporary consecration. It was a voluntary consecration of the Nazarite. And that theme of consecration runs through the next few chapters. The Nazarite in chapter 6. In chapter 7, I think it's the second longest chapter in the Bible, isn't it? Numbers chapter 7. It's the consecration there of the altar, the brazen altar. And you remember that various princes of the nation of Israel, the princes of the tribes, are bringing their voluntary offerings at the consecration and the dedication of that brazen altar. And then chapter 8, we're going to need all of this. Don't worry, we won't be running into the small hours of the night. But when we come to Numbers chapter 8, it's the consecration this time of the Levites themselves. And they are presented as a wave offering before the Lord. Then in chapter 9, commemoration in relation to the Passover. And at the end of chapter 9, this was mentioned in prayer by Brother Peter at the outset of our afternoon gathering, you have the pillar of cloud, and into chapter 10, the call of the silver trumpets before eventually God's people are able to move. So preparation for the wilderness, counting, combat, camping, carrying, cleansing, consecration, commemoration, and a call eventually to move. Well, why do I give you all of that convoluted introduction? For this reason. Sat right in the middle of those 10 chapters is a glorious statement of blessing. And it's to be found at the end of Numbers chapter 6. And I want to read these verses with you. So just look, please, at Numbers 6 and verse 22. This is quite well known, I suppose. It's what we call the high priestly blessing. And so verse 22 of Numbers 6 says this: "And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto Aaron and unto his sons, saying, On this wise ye shall bless the children of Israel, saying unto them, The Lord bless thee and keep thee." That's three words in the original language, the Hebrew. "The Lord make his face shine upon thee and be gracious unto thee." That's five words in the Hebrew. "The Lord lift up his countenance upon thee and give thee peace." That's seven words in the Hebrew. And if you add them all together, 15 words. Take out the three references to the Lord, Jehovah, who is blessing, and there are 12 words. One word for each of the tribes of Israel. What a blessing. And the conferring of this blessing upon the people of Israel. Verse 27, because of the conferment of this blessing, they shall put, that is Aaron and his sons, as they pronounce this blessing, they shall put my name. What a statement that is, by the way. They shall put my name upon the children of Israel, and I will bless them. So the high priestly blessing, I'm going to call it the route to blessing. And we trust that the Lord will indeed bless his word to us tonight. Now, I've already said enough, I think, by way of introduction, but I do want to say just one or two other words in relation to this journey that the children of Israel were about to undertake, and indeed the character of the blessing that we've been reading in Numbers chapter 6. I suppose as God's people moved out through the wilderness, a wilderness journey, it reminds us, doesn't it? We often sing, this world is a wilderness wide. It reminds us of the fact that we are believers who are traveling through the wilderness. Now, I suppose when you come to the epistle to the Ephesians, well, we're already in a spiritual sense across the Jordan, and we're in Canaan, and we are enjoying the spiritual blessings of God. But when you're reading in the Hebrew epistle, the writer to the Hebrews makes it very clear that we as believers are traveling through the wilderness, and we are looking forward to ultimately rest and inheritance that is to be found in the heavenly Canaan. So as we think about the children of Israel moving their way through the wilderness, what a lovely picture it is, and how many practical lessons we can learn for our Christian pilgrimage through the wilderness. Their journey was a real journey of destiny, wasn't it? They weren't so much interested in the journey. They were far more interested in the promised land. That was their destiny. It was their inheritance. And thank God we have an inheritance, incorruptible, that does not and cannot fade away, reserved for us in heaven. Yes, we are on a journey of destiny. But not only was it a journey of destiny, it was a journey that was going to require real determination. They were moving through a hostile environment. Now, when you think of the wilderness, don't think, will you, of the Sahara Desert. It wasn't quite as bad as the Sahara Desert, but certainly a hostile environment, certainly an arid region with very little vegetation and little running water and little sustenance. There certainly was the odd oasis. You remember Elim, that's how the Hebrews would pronounce it, Elim, with its 70 palm trees and all its wells of water. There was the odd oasis. But the people of God couldn't stay there forever. They were journeying. And they'd have to move through this inhospitable environment. They were making their way to their destiny. You know, if the Christian life for us is always a bed of roses, or something has gone wrong, it's nice, isn't it, when we reach the odd Aileen, oasis, and we can enjoy and in a sense relax and find refreshment. But generally speaking, we are moving as the people of God through difficult circumstances and a real wilderness. And let me tell you, in this world, there's very little sustenance for the believer in Christ. So it was a journey of destiny, but a journey that required real determination. I would say that it was a journey of discovery. What were these people learning? Well, it was a journey of discovery in relation to God himself, wasn't it? They were going to get to know God in this environment. And though he had delivered them from Egypt, and though by power and through the blood of the Lamb, he had taken them out of Egypt through the Red Sea, delivered them into the wilderness, yet still there was so much more to be learned about God. A journey of discovery, a discovery about themselves, no doubt, and their unclean and unbelieving hearts, but a greater discovery about God in all his power and his sustaining power and provision. And it would be a journey of development. Because here were a people that emerged out of Egypt as a slave people. And as they're walking through the wilderness, they're going to have to be transformed into a promised land people. A people upon whom God is going to place his name. Wonderful to think like that, isn't it? As we're traveling through the wilderness, isn't it a journey of discovery? What have you discovered about your God in the past year? What have you discovered about his sustaining power and provision? What have you discovered about yourself and the ability of God to meet you in your need? What a journey of discovery and development, because we're being changed from glory to glory, being changed into the likeness of the Son of his love. Now, having said that by way of introduction, I want to bring you back to Numbers chapter 6 and show you this, that God has determined upon this journey and for his people, God has determined that he's going to bless them. He's going to bless them. Now, we were in Ephesians chapter 1 with Brother Kevin earlier on. Think of all the blessings wherewith God has blessed us. And God is determining on this journey, he is going to bless his people if. Now, this is the purpose of Numbers 1 to 10. He is going to bless them and place his name upon them. And that imprint of belonging to him would be seen by all the nations round about if they could follow very simple divine directions that begin in chapter 1 and close in chapter 10. Very simple divine directions for their preservation, for their safekeeping, then God would bless them. And here is the character of the blessing. Have you ever heard a blessing quite like this? We call it oftentimes the high priestly blessing. Isn't it wonderful that this is one of Aaron's first responsibilities as high priest? It was to bless the people. It wasn't Moses. It wasn't Moses who was called by the Lord to bless the people. You see, Moses stood as a representative of the law. And the law cannot bless men. No, it will have to be the high priest. And the one who walked through the court of the tabernacle, the one who ministered at the brazen altar, the one who went into the holy place and once a year went inside the veil and ministered in the Holy of Holies, that high priest, he is the one who is going to bless the people of God. Again, it's Ephesians 1. All of our blessings, positionally speaking, all of our blessings, we have them because of Christ. All that he is and all that he's done. And you think of the glorious way that he moved through the court of this world, dressed resplendent in white garments, the purity of Christ. And he went ultimately to the place called Calvary. And you know this, that when it was that he led the disciples out as far as to Bethany, before he ascended, what did he do? He lifted up his hands and he blessed them. That's Luke's gospel, isn't it? Begins with a priest. It ends with a greater priest. And here is Christ blessing his people, ascending on high. And thank God, the man who sits at God's right hand, he has given us and he still gives us every blessing for the wilderness journey. Now think about the character of this blessing. There are in fact 7 blessings to be found here in 3 pairs. 3 pairs, 2, 4, 6 blessings, and then a final blessing, the 7th. And as you wander down through the blessings, you will find that they are increasingly emphatic. And I don't have time to enter into all of the statements, but let me summarize them like this. From verse 24, the Lord bless thee and keep thee, as the first pair. so that the people of God would be the object of divine preservation. Bless thee and keep thee. Not just the object of divine preservation, but they would be the object of divine provision. Look at verse 25. The Lord make his face shine upon thee, the beam of divine favor, and be gracious unto thee. So that God's people were the object of divine preservation, the object of divine provision. Now, verse 26. The Lord lift up his countenance upon thee and give thee peace. They would enjoy divine peace. And you know that word shalom is all about fullness of prosperity. The enjoyment of divine peace. And ultimately, they could want for nothing more, by the way, if they had that peace. And ultimately, in verse 27, they could enjoy divine presence. What a statement is this? They shall put my name upon the children of Israel. When you and I, when we write our names on something, we are saying, that belongs to me. It's a statement of relationship. It's a statement of ownership. And what a blessing then, the enjoyment of the divine presence. When God would set his seal of ownership upon that nation through their faithfulness and obedience to the divine commands laid out not only in the law, but Numbers 1 to 10. Remember James? James speaks of that worthy name. They blaspheme that worthy name that has been called upon you. My brother, my sister, what a wonderful thing to belong to Christ and to have his name upon us. And in a positional sense, we're the objects of divine preservation. And we're the objects of divine provision. And we enjoy divine peace. And we enjoy the divine presence. We're blessed, aren't we? Blessed with every spiritual blessing. Well, that's just the first part of the ministry. Here's where I'm heading tonight. I want to know, my brother, my sister, if you feel like you are enjoying the full extent of the blessing of God in your everyday practical Christian living. I'm not talking positionally now. We have these blessings. But take your own individual Christian life. Take, please, the assembly to which you belong. Would you say that God is blessing that assembly? Would you say you know the fullness of divine blessing? Would you say you're living in the good of divine blessing? I trust you can answer in the affirmative to the above questions. But something of the circumstances that I see, tell me that isn't quite the case. The object of divine preservation. And yet so many assemblies are closing round about us. And assemblies that were open before COVID will never open again. And you say the enjoyment of divine peace and prosperity. Could it be said that we are knowing something of the fullness of spiritual prosperity in the assembly? That the saints are developing and growing spiritually, and they're contributing to the activities of the assembly and the worship of the assembly, and souls are being saved. And well, you'd have to use more than two hands to count how many have been saved over recent months and years. And the baptistry, well, it's not full of dust and cobwebs. It's open almost all the time. The fullness of the enjoyment of divine prosperity. We know that, do we? What about the enjoyment of divine presence? And the last time you were amongst the people of God and you walked out from the meeting and you said, God was in the place. We felt his presence. We felt his nearness. Well, those who aren't saved coming in and saying, God is amongst you of a truth. Now, if your assembly's like that, let me know where you go. I'd like to visit. But in my experience, we do not know the fullness of divine blessing as we should, as we could. The great question is, why not? Well, I don't have time to develop all this, but Numbers 1 to 10 will tell you why not. Those chapters will explain for you the various conditions, the various requirements and responsibilities that attached to knowing and enjoying the fullness of divine blessing. Now, I'll just share some of them with you, but be prepared to be challenged as I have. First of all, I want to take you back to chapter 2, and I want to talk to you there about the responsibility or the requirement to camp. Look at verse 1 of Numbers 2. The Lord spake unto Moses and unto Aaron, saying, every man of the children of Israel shall pitch by his own standard, with the ensign of their father's house, far off about the tabernacle of the congregation, shall they pitch. And I'm sure you've read this before, and you've thought about the way in which the various tribes were camped in tremendous order around the tabernacle and around the sanctuary, a requirement to camp. You see, it was necessary, wasn't it? We know that the numbers of fighting men were in excess of 600,000 people. So the number of people that were moving through the wilderness were probably in the region of 2 million individuals. And they can't just settle and camp haphazardly. And when the silver trumpets blow, they can't just take off as they will. There would have been chaos. But there needs to be order about it. And God is setting out as a God of order just where it is that the people should camp and how it is they should camp. And verse 2 tells you this. They were to camp far off about the tabernacle. That is at some distance. I wonder if it was 2,000 cubits, as the book of Joshua, you know, as they stood afar off from the Ark of the Covenant as it went down through Jordan. But afar off, at distance, reverence, because God was in the sanctuary. And what a sight, by the way. If you were Balaam and you were up in the mountain looking down in the valley upon the tents, and you saw a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night, and you saw the resplendent beauty of the tabernacle, well, at least the white linen hangings, and then the tents that were pitched round about that tabernacle in perfect order, and the whole camp, as it must have been, several miles across. What beauty. And what order. No wonder Balaam said, Numbers 24, how goodly are thy tents, O Jacob, how beautiful they are as they were spread out. And what about the requirement? What about the preparation then for blessing? Think of this. One people that were united in the Lord. And yet each tribe was separated under their various banners. Now, we don't know what was on the banners, on the end signs of the children of Israel. The rabbis would tell you there was the ensign of the lion that belonged to Judah, and the ensign of the calf, and the man, and the eagle. But imagine, one people united in the Lord, and yet they're divided into their separate tribes, under various banners. And all those banners, at least in the book of the Revelation, they speak of Christ. A lion, a calf, a man, an eagle. Does that remind you of the church? Does it remind you of local churches? One church, one people united in the Lord. And yet separate and individual local churches gathered underneath their banner. And let me tell you this. The banner to which you gather in your local church is no different to the banner to which I gather in my local church. It's Christ, always Christ, ever Christ. There's preparation for the wilderness, to be gathered unto him, to be raising in the wilderness an ensign and a banner unto Christ. And you know I'm going to say this. But here are these tents camped on four sides. Here is a pilgrim people with a sanctuary in the midst, the divine glory was at the heart and center of everything that people was and everything they did. I like to think that all the tents and all the doors of the tents were faced towards the tabernacle, don't you? And I know they might have been spread miles apart, but nevertheless, just a glimpse of glory. Every morning they open the tent door. My brother, my sister, could it be said of you? Could it be said of me? That I, as a pilgrim, traveling through this barren waste, could it be said of me that I live with divine glory? Do I live with the sanctuary at the heart and center of everything I do? I wonder if my life is organized around all that the local assembly is and stands for. I wonder if that fullness of blessing will be known for those who live like that. So there was a requirement to camp. There was a requirement too to carry. You look, for example, in chapter 4 and note this. Verse 5 says, "And when the camp setteth forward, Aaron shall come and his sons, and they shall take down the covering veil and cover the ark of the testimony with it. And they shall put thereon the covering of badger's skins and shall spread over it a cloth wholly of blue and shall put in the staves thereof." Now, that's just one example of how it was that the sons of Aaron were to carry the ark of the covenant through the wilderness. You know that there were three groups in the service of the tabernacle. There were the Kohathites, who were responsible for the furniture, essentially, and the Merarites, who were responsible for the framework of the tabernacle, and then the Gershonites, they were responsible for the fabric of the tabernacle. And let me tell you this, what a privilege it must have been for them. What a privilege just to carry those great things through the wilderness. Well, you say it was a privilege if you were carrying the ark, I suppose, or the laver or the table, you say, but what if you were given the responsibility of one of the pins or one of the pegs? You say, it's not quite such a privilege, is it? Well, let me tell you this. What a privilege to carry it all. Everything was essential. Even the pins. You imagine if you get to the place where they were traveling and they sought to erect the tabernacle and, well, a pin is missing. It would undermine the whole structure of the sanctuary. Everything was essential. And although it must have been such a privilege at first, I do worry that over time it might have become a little monotonous. But can I ask you, if we're going to enjoy fullness of blessing in the assembly and in our lives, we're going to need carriers. Now, what do you carry? In relation to the local assembly, what is it you carry? You say, well, you say, I can't do much, you know. I'm not a public brother. I'm not one for standing on my feet or I just try to be there and do my best. And maybe I can give out a hymn book or two, or maybe I can help some of the saints or put a tract through. I can't do a lot, you know. I'm not a carrier. Not true, my brother, my sister. You're vital. Whatever you might think or know your responsibility is in the assembly, let me tell you, you're vital. If you belong to that fellowship, you might be just carrying a pin. But let me tell you, that pin, that peg, could well be holding and could well be required to build the structure of the whole thing. Remember what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 12 as he's speaking about the body. He says, those members of the body which seem to be more feeble, he says, they're necessary. Vital. You're needed. And if we want to see the blessing of God in our assemblies, you will be needed to put your shoulder to the plough. How long have you been away from the assembly? There are some saints and the assembly's been open for months. The saints are physically gathering, but they've continued to absent themselves. My brother, my sister, time you got back. Time you put your shoulder to the plough. Time you physically gathered with the saints, because they can't do without you. The exercise of the body is impaired if you are not there. And you are not contributing. And let me say something else. These wonderful items of furniture, I'm thinking about those that were in the tabernacle proper and in the court, they were symbols, weren't they, of great and mighty truths. You think of that altar, symbolizing the truth of atonement, and the table symbolizing of showbread, symbolizing the truth of fellowship, and the golden altar, the truth of intercession. And how those various instruments and items of furniture needed to be carried through the wilderness. Now, who's responsible in your assembly for carrying truth? Now, we all are. Because the assembly is the pillar and the ground of the truth. And these truths don't carry themselves. They require saints to hold them aloft. And great truth like the deity of Christ and the headship of Christ and the bodily resurrection of Christ and unlimited atonement and the rapture and the second coming of Christ. All of these truths are vital to be carried through the wilderness, and the saints need to know them. And the saints need to be taught them. And the saints need to be responsible for carrying them. Sad to say, some churches these days have left the brazen altar behind. Could you imagine that they got to Kadesh Barnea and they're establishing the tabernacle, and they began with the ark and set up the Holy of Holies, and they got to the court and they said, where are the Kohathites? Where are the boys responsible for the brazen altar? And they left it back at Sinai. couldn't imagine such a thing. And yet some churches have left the altar behind. They're not preaching Christ crucified anymore. It's all gone. I heard an illustration that just touched the heart of a church that preached and loved to preach Christ crucified. And even outside the church, on the entrance into the courtyard of the church, above the gate, there was literally written above the gate, "We preach Christ crucified." And everyone that was coming into the church and under that gate, they knew what they stood for as they preached. And as years rolled by, the ivy began to grow and it covered crucified. "We preach Christ." He said, "That's not a bad thing." You know, it sort of reflected the preaching in the church, because far from mentioning the cross, they preached Christ and the greatness of Christ and the life of Christ and emulating the life of Christ. No one will ever be saved by emulating the life of Christ. "We preach Christ." They left the altar. As time went by, the ivy covered Christ. And it just said, "We preach." And boy, did they preach in that church. All manner of things. All manner of human philosophies, the maxims of the world and the day. But Christ was forgotten. And Christ crucified. Sad to say, there are some local assemblies that have left the altar behind. I've been told to be careful what I preach in the gospel, in certain assemblies. They say, "We don't want to hear the blood. That will offend the young folks and the mothers. We don't want to hear anything about blood or the cross. You just be careful how you preach. We'll never know blessing unless we preach Christ crucified." And let me tell you this, as they're walking through the wilderness, and if you're up on that mountaintop and you're looking down to the valley and you're seeing that wonderful procession, if you were able to see the items of furniture that were traveling through the wilderness, there is one item that would stick out like a sore thumb. That was the Ark of the Covenant. Because it was the only item which on the outside has a covering wholly of blue. What's the blue? The Ark of the Covenant. That which speaks of Christ glorified. And it was conspicuous. My brother, my sister, let's preach Christ. Is your assembly preaching? Are you making Christ conspicuous? What are you doing? I am concerned that many assemblies feel that the regular weekly gospel meeting is just enough. And that we hope by some kind of miracle that the Spirit will draw folks in, but will not invite them or speak to them or say anything to them. We'll just have the gospel meeting and that will do. It's our responsibility. Now, come on. We want to know the blessing of God. Where is all the preaching of Christ crucified God? Think about it as you enter, or exit, I should say, lockdown. And COVID, we trust. A requirement to camp. A requirement to carry. We want to see blessing. Come to chapter 5, you'll find this. There's a requirement to cleanse. You see, external order and correctness is all well and good. But it must be accompanied by personal purity. We read this on the way through, Numbers 5 and verse 3. You remember that the Lord is saying to Moses, "Put out of the camp every leper." And he says in verse 3, for this reason, he says, "This is the camp in the midst of which I dwell." There must be purity about our lives. Purity about the lives of the individuals that make up local churches. because that's where God dwells. The local assembly is the habitation of God. The Spirit of God dwells there. 1 Corinthians 3, ye are temple of God, and the Spirit of God dwelleth in among you as a testimony, as a company. Christ said, where two or three, there am I in the midst. God, the Spirit, Christ, present in the local assembly as we gather. Purity is a must. The requirement to cleanse is critical. As you think of God's people as they were camped, the ever-present danger that there was of defilement, that could be disastrous. Just a little defilement in the camp could spread a plague throughout the tents, throughout the people. You know, it was said of the Roman army that at times a plague killed far more Roman soldiers than ever they lost in battle. And Paul says, as he's writing to the Corinthians, he says, listen, a little leaven, just a little bit, it leavens the lump. And says the Lord here to Moses, chapter 5, he says, the leper, sin in the flesh. That leper must be put without the camp. Says Paul to the Corinthians, you're puffed up. You've celebrated the fact that this man is a wicked man for what he's done. He needs to be put out. Cleanse the camp that you might see something of the blessing of God. My brother, my sister, our individual lives and the purity of them have a tremendous impact upon the blessing of God in the assembly. And if we're not seeing the blessing we think we should or would like, it could be that defilement needs to be cleansed. And as you read down through Numbers chapter 5, and when you come to verses 5 to 10, you find that now it's not cleansing in relation to a leper. But now it's speaking about offences that were committed between individual brethren that belonged to the camp of Israel. Those who had offended one another, or those who had been deceitful or taken from others what was not theirs, and even offences that I have or hold, or grudges that I have or hold against another believer, can restrict the unity and therefore the blessing of God in the assembly. Sad, isn't it? When saints are gathering around the table, and they're putting their hand to the loaf, symbolizing unity and fellowship. And there are saints in that meeting they haven't spoken to for years. God will not bless. Now, those individuals didn't need to be put out of the camp, but those individuals needed to confess, and reparation needed to be made, and the debt paid, and 25% besides. You should be more of a brother and sister to that individual that you've offended than ever before. We want to see the blessing of God. And you say, what about all of this very strange language? Now, I'm impinging upon your knowledge of the book of Numbers, but you will know about the jealousy offering. When you come down to verse 12, for example, speak unto the children of Israel and say to them, if any man's wife go aside and commit a trespass against him, and verse 14, and the spirit of jealousy come upon him, and he be jealous of his wife, and she be defiled. Or if the spirit of jealousy, it's this jealousy offering. And here's a husband now who suspects that his wife has been unfaithful. And so he brings an offering of jealousy And you remember that the water, the bitter water, was mixed with some of the dust of the tabernacle, the very presence of God. And she was to drink that water, and so on and so forth. The point is this, in the light of the blessing of God, that there was the suspicion of secret unfaithfulness. The suspicion of secret unfaithfulness. And the dispensational thought of this jealousy offering is the nation of Israel moving through the wilderness and ultimately planted in the land. And yet they had gone after idols. And so this jealousy offering was a testing of the affections of the bride in the wilderness and the love of thine espousals in relation to that nation had waned. And she went after idolatry. And ultimately, Israel will be sorely tested. And that in the tribulation. Before, thank God, being restored. Now, if you think of the jealousy offering in a dispensational setting, you will find that there was no trial for a husband who had been suspected of unfaithfulness, just the wife. Why? Because the Lord was ever faithful to his people. Now, from the dispensational to the typical, you say, what is the thought then in this context of blessing? My brother, my sister, this should strike us. The suspicion of secret unfaithfulness. Oh, it's easy to play the part when you're in the assembly. It's easy to play the part when you're sitting amongst the saints. Say the right things, do the right things. But secretly away from the assembly, and away from the eyes of the saints, there's unfaithfulness to the Lord. The testing of the bride's affection. Now that was the assembly at Ephesus, wasn't it? And Paul had told them in his epistle, love, love. And you come to the epistle from Christ and he says you've left. Left your first love. Is it possible we've moved away in our heart's affection from that first love for Christ? Do you remember that if this wife, this woman was guilty and she drank that water, you remember the curse would come upon her, her belly would swell. That is, the flesh was magnified and her thigh would rot. What language, eh, in the Authorized Version? That is, it would affect her walk. You see, you can always tell those who have waned in their affection for Christ. The flesh will be magnified. The walk will be affected. Unless you think this has no application to us, Paul takes this up in 2 Corinthians 11. And Paul says, I am jealous over you. Paul plays the part of a faithful, loyal father. And he's thinking about the assembly at Corinth as his chaste virgin daughter. He says, I am jealous over you with a godly jealousy. He says, I have espoused you to one husband. Yet he says, you've been corrupted from the simplicity that is in Christ. Drawn away from a pure, undivided devotion to Christ. And following now another gospel and another Jesus. God keep us from that. What have we been drawn away by? Total and absolute affection and devotion to Christ. Secret unfaithfulness. We'll never know the blessing of God if there's unfaithfulness amongst us. I need to finish, but I finish with this. The requirement to camp, the requirement to carry, the requirement to cleanse When you come to chapters 6, 7, and 8, the requirement for consecration. Consecration. Now I'm testing your consecration because it's 8 o'clock. I can see, but you can't, those who are leaving the call. How devoted are they to the teaching of the Word of God? You can't leave now, can you? A requirement for consecration. There's the consecration of the Nazarite, chapter 6. Consecration of the altars in the middle. Consecration of the Levite in chapter 8. And in chapter 6, when it comes to the Nazarite, there's a provision for devotion. And this wasn't a particular individual as such. It was open to any. Any individual of the nation who sought just to rise above the spiritual mediocrity of the day. Well, they could take a Nazarite vow. It's voluntary. If they take the vow. It was only short for a number of weeks or months. But they could devote and dedicate themselves to God in consecration. And what lives they lived. Disciplined lives. They were restricted in terms of their social interaction. That was the wine and the grapes. They abandoned dependence upon themselves. That was the growing of the long hair and the shame and the dependence that it demonstrated upon God. And the avoidance of sin, not to touch any dead body. And they're absolutely devoting themselves, sacrificing legitimate things in many cases in order that they might give extra devotion to the Lord himself. Do we have any Nazarites amongst us? How many in your assembly that would sacrifice very legitimate things? A promotion at work, going out with friends, but sacrifice those legitimate things in order that they might devote more time and more energy to the things of Christ. All a requirement for consecration. And the Levite in chapter 8, a wave offering of the Levite. They were dedicated to their service in chapter 8. And along with various offerings that were waved before the Lord, the essential point is this, the Levites themselves were being waved before the Lord. They were being offered as a living sacrifice before God. Problem with a living sacrifice as opposed to a dead sacrifice is that a living sacrifice very often, well, it jumps off the altar. If it has the choice. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice. That's the way we should be living. Too often we're getting off the altar. We may have been waved before the Lord the moment we were saved, but we're not on the altar any longer. Anything but him. Anything but the assembly. I'll organize my life first and the assembly fits around. We've got the wrong priorities. We won't know the blessing of God. You say, what a life. Who would consecrate themselves as a Nazarite? Who would consecrate themselves as a Levite? Although I suppose they didn't have any choice. Well, right in the middle of that, you have Numbers 7. And what does number 7 give you? It gives you a view of the altar. A brazen altar. And those Levites must have watched. As the princes of Israel voluntarily express their estimation and their value of the altar. Every one of them is recorded in the Word of God. That's why it's so long. But they valued that altar. And the Levites watched and they were looking. And they were impressed. with the value that God's people put upon the altar of the tabernacle. Speaks of the cross of Christ. My brother, my sister, I will only ever be consecrated to him and his service as a Nazarite and as a Levite, as far as I appreciate who he is and what he's done at Calvary. When I survey the wondrous cross on which the Prince of Glory died, my richest gain, I count but loss and pour contempt on all my pride. That's the route to blessing. Gathering to Christ, that's the camping. Exalting Christ, that's the carrying. Becoming like Christ, that's the cleansing. And devotion to Christ, consecration. May God grant to us that we will see blessing in a practical sense in each of our lives and in the assembly to which we belong. God will bless his word.